This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith episode number 113, and it's early October 2015. Chris Loring joins me this week to discuss Czech lagers. A quick reminder, you can listen to all 113 episodes of the Beersmith podcast just by going to beersmith.com/radio on your phone, computer, or tablet and clicking on the play button. Streaming 24/7, we have all 113 episodes available. Thank you to this week's sponsor, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're now offering a full 6 issues a year, up from 4 at a great discount. They're offering a new discount code, which gives you 15% off everything in their store, including subscriptions and training. The new code is BeerSmith2015. I encourage you to check out this great new magazine for craft brewers and beer brewers at beerandbrewing.com and use the offer code BeerSmith2015 to get your 15% discount today. And also, Beersmith. Design great beer, brew with confidence, and brew your best beer ever with Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith lets you create your own recipes from scratch or access tens of thousands of recipes online on the Beersmith Cloud. Also, our desktop and mobile version work seamlessly together to make your brewing day easier. Give Beersmith a try today by downloading the free 21-day trial at beersmith.com. Get your free trial today at beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Chris Loring. Chris is the founder of Notch Brewing. He has been a professional brewer since 1993. He launched Notch in 2010 to focus exclusively on session beer. He's opening a new Notch Brewery facility in Salem, Mass. In 2015. Chris, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. We're opening in 2016, so it'll be early next year. I wish it was 2015, but so early next year, probably April.
That's exciting. So have you been gypsy brewing since then, or what have you been doing?
Yeah. So, when I started Notch, I didn't want to build a bricks and mortar facility based around a concept that no one believed in. And I know that's hard to believe today that session beer was a concept no one believed in, but in 2008, 2009, when I really wanted to bring session beer, to the forefront, I wasn't going to be able to raise money, to get a brick and mortar facility. So that was part of my decision making to use other, excess capacity of brewers that I knew. But the other part was just scale, and that session beer doesn't get the great margins that say, triple IPA or double IPA will get. So I needed scale right away to make it profitable. So contracting was the first step, or gypsy brewing, whatever you want to call it, was the first step for me to get to the point where I could produce the beers I want, at the price that I want and the quality that I wanted.
Well, that's awesome. I'm looking forward to the new brewery opening up as well. So today you wanted to talk a little bit about Czech lagers, and you said you've been brewing these as a session beer, which I find kind of interesting. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I had this brewer epiphany, I think around 2005, where my previous brewing gigs, I'd always done beers influenced by, say, British ales. And I knew about British session beer, and I was trained under two British brewers. I went to Siebel, and so I was schooled in the German technique, but I never was really exposed to Czech beer. And so I went to the Czech Republic for a couple weeks in 2005 and realized that the majority of beer they consume is 4% alcohol. And it's their pub beer, and it's something you have multiple pints at in a single, session, if you will. And these beers were wildly flavorful. They were 4% pale lagers that were just great. And you're starting with 10 Plato beer, and the result is not a beer that tastes like a Bud Light. It's a beer that's rich and full and hoppy. And so I started at that point, I was like, there's something here I really want to explore with session beer. Mm-hmm. And so when I started Notch, everyone thought I'd come out with a British bitter. And to me, that was just repetitive of what was on the market. We've been through that. I really wanted to expose these beers that hadn't been brewed in the United States, but also show that these are great session beers as well. So that really was the reason I went down that path.
So, I mean, a lot of us are familiar with the American Pilsners, the Budweiser, Michelob, whatever, based loosely on the Czech styles. What's different about the beers you're brewing?
Well, I think, there's a number of things there. From the broad picture, it's that these beers are not produced to be a session beer. The brewer doesn't look at these saying, how do we dumb down a, you know, 5% Pilsner and make it 4%? I mean, they start from the ground up, and these just happen to be the ABVs. It's like a Berliner Weiss. You know, it's a style that was created, and right now it just happens to be around 3 to 4%. And we're not looking at this saying like, all right, we need to dumb this down. That was a really big interest to me in how these brewers are going about getting these flavors, aromas, and character in a beer that was, you know, a modest gravity and ABV. So I think the big difference is that in the Czech Republic, they look at beer in terms of color and strength. It's almost a grid. Ron Pattinson has a great, great overview of Czech beer on his website. And
I'm trying to remember the name of his website. It's
we'll get there before the end of this. We'll give him credit.
I'll pull it up.
Yeah. So, but you look at it, and they brew to strengths of 10, 12, 14 Play-Doh, and then they brew to color range of pale, amber, and black or dark. And so you can have three different styles of 10 Play-Doh beer, being either pale lager, amber lager, or dark lager, and then moving up in strength. And each one of these are really different. There are some comparisons to the German styles in that color and range, but none of them, the Germans really don't have the 10 Play-Doh character don't have the 10 Play-Doh styles like the Czech Republic does, and they certainly don't drink them in the quantity that the Czech Republic does.
Yeah, I did find the website. It's Shut Up About Barclay Perkins, of course. Memorable Ron Pattinson's website. He does a lot of work with historical beers, so I'll give him credit there.
Yeah, and one thing that, you know, when I first went there, I expected Czech Pilsner, what they call pale lager, to be this monolithic style where everything kind of tastes the same. You know, like the British bitter. It's 3.5%, and the slight variances on each one of those beers. In the Czech Republic, within Pilsner, there's a wide variety of interpretations of what that beer tastes like, smells like, you know, feels like on the palate. Not only at 10, but 12, and either some of the stronger lagers that they have there. I hear in the United States a lot that, you know, Pilsner should be X. And I scratch my head at that, because the interpretations of Pilsner in not only the Czech Republic, but then you go to Germany, and even within Germany, that there's so many different interpretations of what Pilsner is. So the American beer geek looks at Pilsner and said, Pilsner should be X. It's like, well, that's not really the case. It's like, you could have, you know, 10 variants of that, you know, so what exactly are you talking about? And I think that comes from a place where we just haven't paid attention very much to Pilsner as a great style with great history and a lot of variants. So, you know, I think only now we're really trying to understand that as American brewers.
So Chris, I was wondering if you could share a little bit about the history of the Czech lager.
Yeah, in terms of history, I'm always hesitant today to talk about history of beer styles, because every day I learn that a lot of the things we were told turned out to be myths. You know, the IPA debate as far as being a strong beer, I'm like, all right, that's what I was fed when I started brewing, and, you know, 20 years later, that's all been turned upside down. So Czech lagers were really the first pale lager that was produced, something that had a great clarity to it. That went hand in hand with the Bohemian glassmakers, and they wanted to show this great clarity, and, you know, the glassware, you know, augmented that you could see that. And that's a story I've been told. I'm not really sure how much that is based in mythology and in truth. But I think in terms of, you know, a style, it went in a different path from Germany. I think one is because of water, where there's very soft water in the Czech Republic. And then, you know, Germany tends, depending on the location, it may have a little more, you know, hard water. So I think both those beers evolved in a different way, and definitely in the Czech Republic evolved in a different way in terms of strength, you know, but also in flavor profile. We always look to, you know, Pilsner Kell is the original source of where, you know, Czech lager was created. And there's a lot of great sources out there for understanding Czech Pilsner, and I'm really not a great historian with that. I'm more in tune with, you know, what the beer's about and the specs of the beer and the flavor profiles of the beer.
So Chris, in the new BJCV style guide, we see they actually broke out a whole bunch of categories for Czech lager now, including Czech pale lager, as well as a premium amber and dark. What are the significance of the new categories?
It's recognition by the United States that the Czech Republic makes more than one style. I was pretty thrilled with that. And that, we have, you know, categories for, you know, 10 different variants of a barrel strength thing that was just created 10 years ago. But in Czech Republic, these beers have been brewed for hundreds of years, and we just starting to get a sense that, all right, in the United States, that there's more than one style of beer. So that was great. I was pretty proud that two of my beers were selected as examples in the BGCP style guide. My my 10 pale lager, which I call session pills, and then my Chardonnay Pivo, which is a Czech black lager. So it was cool to see that, but really just the recognition that there's more going on there than just pale lager or pilsner. And I think it's fun for the consumer. I mean, it's variety, and that's what, especially today, the consumers want variety, and to see that there's, you know, another country that we haven't paid attention to, and they have good variety of beer, and maybe there'll be some more examples of that being brewed in the United States. I think I'm starting to see that. And then these beers are tough to import to the States. They don't travel very well. They're pretty delicate, and the brewers aren't really set up to export. So I think it's up to the United States, our brewers here, to start brewing interpretations of those. The 10 Plato pale lager, I still don't know if anyone's brewing that in the United States. I've been brewing it now for 4 years. It's my number one selling beer, and it's interesting to me no one else is taking a shot at that. But I have seen a lot of brewers going down the dark, you know, Tamavi or Chardonnay, which is dark or black lagers at 10 to 12 Plato. I've seen a lot of examples of those. And those are different than, you know, the Dunkel or Schwarz beer of Germany. And they're subtle differences, but they're there. So I think that's a significance that, you know, that we've recognized it, and that, you know, we'll see more examples being brewed in the United States. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's great. I'm looking forward to seeing a lot more of these being brewed in competition. You know, certainly, as soon as they put them into the style guide, they start popping up everywhere. That's a great thing.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you, how strong and hoppy are these beers? What's the variation of range that we look at in this style?
I find the pale lagers to be pretty hoppy, and that's relative term. But compared to, say, if you were in Munich and drank Helles all week, and then you went to the Czech Republic and had any of their pale lagers, they're very much more hop forward in terms of flavor and aroma. I wouldn't call them bitter, but I definitely call them, you know, well balanced in the finish. So they're an elegant beer. They're very, very subtle and elegant, and it's all in the balance. Nothing leaps out, but they're, you know, the hop character is, you know, definitely there. It's typically Saaz. I mean, it's really the hop that you're going to, the character you're going to find in that beer.
Yeah, the spicy, kind of spicy hop, right?
Spicy cedar, you know, the typical kind of, you know, noble Saaz hop quality. You're not going to find a lot of fruit in the aroma at all. You know, for me, that's great because I had this fruit all over the place and where I drink. And so I like to have these beers that have a different character. So then the strength is based on, you know, what you want. So you walk in the pub, they're listed by Plato, not by alcohol content, which is a little odd because the alcohol content, as you know, can vary based on the attenuation, but they're fairly consistent. 10 Plato is typically a 4% beer. 12 Plato is typically a 5% beer, and 14 is typically a 6% beer, which they consider very strong. And it is if you have, you know, four of them in the pub. So again, the strengths are just, they're there, but I think, based on what I've read, that, you know, the 4% pale lager is vast majority of what's consumed there. It's changing. Last time I was there 2 years ago, you know, a lot of the younger brewers look to pale lager as, you know, granddad's beer, and they're starting to brew IPAs and getting more diversity. Yeah. And I'd say that'd be the only, that'd be a, you know, criticism of the beer culture there, is that there's not a wide variety. There's a variety, but nothing like we have in the United States. And that's starting to change. We're starting to see, you know, a little bit more of these, not only Czech styles, but, you know, styles that aren't Czech coming out.
Well, let's switch over to brewing a Czech lager, starting with a grain bill. What does a grain bill look like for a typical beer?
Well, if we look at a pale lager or a pilsner, I found some interesting things. And one thing that really I thought was interesting is that a caramel or a crystal malt typically makes up 2-3% of the grist. And again, what I was always told is that the color of the Czech pale lager, which is darker, more deeper gold than, say, a Czech, a German or American pils, was created by decoction, you know, the boiling and creating a melanoidins, et cetera. But I got more that a little bit of, you know, caramel, you know, at the lighter end of a crystal malt is contributing a little bit to that color as well. And so I integrated that into some of my recipes and found that it was a good way to create body without sweetness, but also a little bit of color to make it a little more deeper.
So you're actually adding crystal malt then, huh?
I don't add crystal malt. I add a caramel. I don't want to give away my source because I use a pretty unique one. Okay. It's not unique. You could find it. It's just unexpected, right? But you could use, you know, say, you know, Vireman has foam or carahel, you know, something like that. I think at a very small amount would would contribute for the lower gravity beers. As you go, I don't know this for a fact, but I think as you go up the gravity scale, you can cut back on those caramels and get mouthfeel and color, et cetera, from just having more malt, more Pilsner malt. So the Pilsner malt tends to be floor malted, lower modified grain that requires a step infusion or a decoction regime for the conversion. And that's they hold pretty tight to the decoction methods and tradition.
So are they using a three-stage decoction or what are they doing?
A double and triple from everyone I talked to. A single, I didn't really hear anyone saying single. And I didn't hear anyone saying that they were doing step infusion. I know a lot of German brewers have moved to step and they argue that you can't tell the difference, but the Czech brewers are pretty adamant. The Czechs are a lot like the Brits. They hold tight to their traditions, and they don't want to change them, which I think is great. Because there's something in that, there's some secret sauce in the Czech beers that, it's tough to replicate. Mm-hmm. And part of it may be the decoction. I do believe that. I find it difficult to do a decoction brew for a 10 Plato beer, because I want that attenuation to be limited. I don't want it to have full attenuation because it's going to dry the beer out to the point where you're going to have very little malt character. So, I tend to, in my step mash for my 10 Plato beer, my first step is a high conversion temperature. I can have a little bit of residual malt character left in that beer.
So are you doing a full decoction or are you mainly using a step?
I'm using a step for my 10 Plato. I've found that the decoction is very difficult. And I know the Czech brewers do a decoction. I don't have the amount of iterations in that beer to figure that out yet. And in the new brewery in Salem, that will be up early next year, we're having a decoction brew house, dedicated decoction mash mixer, et cetera. In the brew house that we're going to experiment a lot, with decoction and show its influence over, a range of strengths, not only session beers, but non-session beers, and serve them side by side and let the consumer decide, if all the costs and labor and utilities is worth the extra 3 hours in the brew house.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to do a triple decoction. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's probably a labor of love. But the Czech brewers do hold tight to the decoction and also copper, Pilsner Kell, the brewery has been really criticized for a lot of the modernization that has happened there. The removal of open fermentation, the removal of, wood tanks, going to stainless. But when they upgraded their brew house, they still do the decoction in copper. Wow. Yeah. And they feel that's a very important flavor addition to the beer. So it was interesting to see that's where they, in the modernization, that was one thing they wouldn't remove.
Hey, I would go back for a minute. You talked about the caramel. What percentage are we talking about? I assume it's a pretty low percentage for the lighter beers.
Yeah, for the lighter beers, 2-3% is fine. You're going to get what you need. I think
that's pretty subtle. Yeah,
it's pretty subtle. Over that, you're going to start to taste. You're going to get away from that. That kind of elegance, for lack of another term, of that beer. You're going to start getting, that caramely sweetness that really isn't appropriate for that style. And Czech. The other thing here is that Czech Pilsner. It's not this. Beer that the United States beer geek should be, crystal clear and really dry and bright and clean. Maybe some German beers are like that, especially the more industrial beers. The ones in the Czech Republic, I find not to be that. I find them to be creamy. The soft water gives a soft palate, so you're not going to have the snappy finish that people think a Pilsner should have. It's going to be a nice dry finish, but the expectation of what the American beer geek thinks Pilsner should be is not what you're going to find in the beers in the Czech Republic. You're going to find something a little bit different. I hear a lot that, from American brewers that Pilsner should have this minerally character and it should be, aggressively hopped. And I think they're thinking of one German beer. And if you go to the Czech Republic, I mean, the water is very soft. It gives a soft palate. It gives a creaminess to the beer. Some of that's in the dispense as well. They have an interesting way of dispensing. Their lagers on the tap that it leads to this kind of really nice head retention and creaminess, that perception of creaminess as you drink through the foam.
Yeah, I did a little beer tasting the other day, and I had some real Czech lagers, and trying to compare the difference with some friends between that and a regular beer, it was pretty amazing. They really could taste the difference,
Yeah, even among the beers, the one thing I always tell people to do is to have Pilsner Kell next to Budvar. And those are two wildly different beers. Mm-hmm. Within a category, wildly, it's not like, you know, IPA to the Pilsner, but among the Pilsner category, those beers have a different approach. And I think it's a good representation of how, you know, we look at, you know, Pilsner as being monolithic, and it really isn't. I do tastings all the time, and someone says, "Nah, this doesn't taste like a Czech Pilsner." I'm like, "Well, what's your reference point?" And that leads to the discussion of, "Well, that's just one of many, you know, variants of what that beer can taste like."
So let's talk for a minute about brewing a darker variation. You know, an amber or a dark.
Yeah, those are fun beers. So I have two beers that I brew. For the amber, I always screw up the pronunciation, but Polotamave, which is a Polo and Tamave, which translation is half dark, which is basically amber. In that beer, I brew at a 12 Plato because the attenuation finish is fairly high, so it's a 4% beer. And that beer is predominantly Vienna and Munich malt. Mm-hmm. And there's no Pils malt in that at all. And I add a little bit of a Carrot malt in there as well. I use Carrot Bohemian in that for Environ. I find Carrot Bohemian to be a little bit aggressive in the pale lagers. I think it's 50 to 60 Lovibond off the top of my head. It's a little bit darker for what I would want to do in a pale lager. But for, you know, as you start getting into ambers and darker beers, it works really well.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with Carrot Bohemian. I assume it's a crystal style malt, right?
Yeah, I kind of look at it as a
light crystal.
A Czech crystal malt, like right in the, you know, medium to light, but not
too
light.
Yeah, 60 is pretty dark. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's dark. And you know, what we think is dark crystal malt today is different mm-hmm. than we thought was, you know, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. That beer, the Polotamave in particular, the amber lager, there's an old school version that the breweries that, you know, had brewed that style almost disappeared. And I think it was Star Prominent that brought it back. I might be wrong there. They tend to be a little sweeter, not as hoppy. And some of the newer breweries there, it tends to be a little drier and hoppier. And that's the version I like a lot. And not crazy hoppy. I'm not talking IPA. I'm just talking apparent Saaz hop flavor and character, which in an amber lager is a really nice character to have. Because I find amber lagers to be a little dull if it's just malt. Because you really have to nail that malt character. And so it's really hard for a brewer to do that. But the amber lager with a little bit of that Saaz, or even you could do a U.S. equivalent, like Sterling, I think would be really nice hop in that. It would gain a little bit of fruitiness from Sterling, but I think would be appropriate or fun within that beer. And then the dark category, it's not quite as dry as a Schwarz beer. It's not quite as sweet as a Dunkel. It's right kind of in between. But again, the old school Chardonnays, black or Tamave, which is dark, tend to be a little sweeter. And there's rumors that a lot of the old school brewers there would just add, basically a coloring agent at the end. And some of them were just really sweet. I mean, you know, not really a good session beer because after one, you need to dry your palate out. But the ones that are true to interpretation tend to be medium bodied. Not terribly roasty. You're not looking at a stout roastiness. So right. You're looking at a Carafa special, you know, dehusk type of dark malt would work really well here. Not in high proportions.
Like a special B or something. Well, you said dehusk though.
Dark malt. I think best.
You don't want the bitterness, right?
You want the bitterness. You want that husk remove. Also tannin. You know, one of the big concerns in brewing a session beer is that, mm-hmm. Tannins will present themselves in ways that are very unpleasant. So, pH, last runnings, that's a whole different topic, but you know, you start to extract some tannins near the end of runoff. And if you have a lot of dark malts, that's going to add to that and kind of make the unpleasant bite. You want this to be fairly soft. So be careful with the darker malts. I think it's no sin to use some of these dehusked Carafa malts and then use a little bit of Cinnamar. To darken that up.
And it's great because the maltsters are starting to come out with a lot of dehusked malts, which don't have those tannins, don't have those bitter flavors in.
Yeah, because this shouldn't be a bitter beer. It should be a malty beer. So when you get down to a 10 Plato or a 12 Plato beer that's delicate like that, any bitterness, whether it comes from the hop or it comes from the grain, is going to be unpleasant. You're really trying to ride that balance point without being sweet either. My Chardonnay Pivo is a 10.5 Plato beer. It finishes pretty high. It finishes around 4 Plato. This is all ballpark, but it may be a little bit lower than that, 3.5. Because I want some malt character there. I want that to, you know, feel like a bigger beer, but still be dry enough at the end of the finish that you want to have five of them, or maybe two.
What hops are you using for all these beers? I assume it's probably Saaz, but...
Yeah, I use Saaz. I've experimented with a couple of like Czech varieties. They have Saaz variants and whatnot, but Saaz still is like my go-to. I will use some German hops, I think, of a similar character in some of the noble varieties. Mm-hmm. I do like a couple of U.S. hops, as substitutions. I really like Sterling a lot. Unfortunately, there's a lot of the larger craft brewers have started brewing Pilsners, and that hop has become a little bit more difficult to get a hold of. But I think Sterling is a really nice one. It has a lot of the Saaz character with just a little bit more what I would call lemon or citrus, but not in that mm-hmm. passion fruity, juicy fruity way, just a little bit. I think Saaz has a little bit of lemon in it. And I think the Sterling like amplifies that just a little bit. And I think that's really nice. I think it's for lagers. I think it's a really nice character to bring in, but with, some subtlety in it.
Nice. And obviously the water profile is very important for this particular style of beer. What kind of water are you using?
So I'm on the North Shore, and our water source comes from the Ipswich River, which has, it's a makeup that I like quite a bit. It's very soft. There's not a lot of sulfites, not a lot of calcium. There's some chloride in there, but overall it's very, very soft. And the only thing, the chloride's actually, would add a little bit of perceived palate fullness. And sometimes I actually add a little bit more. So I'm starting from a very soft source, which I think is important.
Which is similar to what they use over there, right?
Yeah, correct. I mean, really low, total mineral content, which again, I think is that softness. I mean, you can make a Pilsner with hard water. It's going to be more of its German Northern variant, that mineral character that I think is actually nice and restrained. So I don't think it's impossible, but if that Czech softness, I think you're really looking for something that'd be a little bit soft. So you have a soft water source and you can just stop there. If you have a hard water source, then, you may have a little more difficult getting that, mineral character. You know?
Mix in some distilled or something maybe.
Yeah. At the homebrew level is, you'd have to just find an alternative source for that. Not off your tap. If you have a hard water source, if you have a deep well, it might be really, that's hard. It might be really tough to
emulate. I have that problem here. I have a well and it's much too hard to brew with. I have to use a lot of bottles, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. So soft water, that's preferable. Calcium chloride, can help for some of the lower gravity beers. I think as you get up to 12 and 14, you really wouldn't need any additions if you're starting with soft.
Mm-hmm. And then we already talked a little bit about the mash and the process you use, but I was wondering if you could walk us through, what a typical mash profile might look like for a beer like this.
For a Czech lager, you would do, a multiple step infusion or decoction. And if you're using the floor malted varieties from the Czech Republic, you're going to need to start at a protein rest, and then move up to the conversion temperatures. What's traditional, you'll have a protein rest at a certain temperature. You'll come in at the lower end.
You'd be looking at 100 to 120, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit, I guess.
120 is a good ballpark. You'd be looking at a couple conversion temperatures, and one in like the mid 140s, and getting up, then the second one being up into the 158 to 160. Some go a little higher.
So you're hitting both the low and the high end of the mash range, right?
Correct. And that's where I find it difficult to do a 10 Plato beer, because you're pretty much going to, you're going to convert your fermentable sugars pretty quickly at that lower range, and that beer is going to dry out. I mean, the yeast is just going to attack those simple sugars, and you're not going to be left with very much.
So you're saying with the heavier or the higher gravity beers, you actually maybe skip the lower step or pick something in the middle?
With the lower gravity beers, skip the lower step. If you have a malt that is well modified, I would, and you're trying to hit
which
like
almost all the modern ones are, right?
Yeah. So you can do a step infusion, but I think if we're focusing on the lower range of Czech beer, for a home brewer, I think it's a pretty good practice. You can mash in pretty hot, and you can mash into what your desired conversion temperature is. And if you wanted to do a step out of that, for mash out, or what the Czechs would call it, fake decoction, because it's not a conversion temperature, you could boil off a third of the mash and bring that back in, and then have that be raised to mash out temperature. If you want to get some of those melanoidins, if you can't do a decoction, there is, I think, best environment, both of a melanoidin malt, which is, the intent is that will emulate some of the character you have in
right. Yeah, I've used that trick before. You add a little melanoidin malt, and it gives you a little bit of that malty flavor that you might get, even though you're using a single infusion, right?
Right. I mean, that's the intent. I think it's a nice malt, and I think it does bring some character. Is it exactly what you would get in decoction? I'm not really sure. I'm going to kind of prove that out next year, because one of the many things we're going to do with our brew house is to brew the same recipe, but just with variance in grain substitutions, and then step versus decoction, and see what we're getting, so we can prove these things out. I mean, it's great to pontificate about it, but until you do it, you really never know. So the mash temps are, I would say as you go higher in gravity, 12 to 14, in Plato, I think you could do the dual conversion temperatures and then go to mash out. So it just depends how much time you want to spend, boiling. The reference article you sent me, sure, I thought was excellent. Czech Pale Lager and Brew Your Own by Gordon Strong.
Yeah, Strong. He did an article fairly recently, and it is available online, I think, BYO, right? BYO.com.
I'm looking at it right now, and he touches on a lot of what I talk about, and I think he did a really nice job to make it simple, not too confusing, and a good transition to the homebrew setup, as well.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes, but Gordon wrote a recent article in Brew Your Own. It was I can't go over the whole thing, but I'll put a link in the show notes. But he covered the new styles, which is kind of neat, and he did a pretty good job with it, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. He talked a little bit about pulling a decoction for homebrewers and how you do that, et cetera. So it was a nice one. And he has a lot of good hints for recipe development as well. I thought there's some good stuff in there.
Good. Well, let's talk about yeast. What yeast do you prefer to use?
I've used a variety of lager yeasts, and I like the ones that are highly influenced by mash temperature and mash schedule, in the resulting final gravity. Again, my focus is on session beer, and so that final gravity to me is everything. One, I have to nail my ABV. I need to make sure that my promise is there, that this beer is actually, four, whatever percent I tell people. So I have to have a consistency in final attenuation. And the other is that I want to make sure it finishes high enough that the beer isn't bone dry. I make some bone dry beers that get down to 2. To Plato, but that's the intent, or these beers tend to, that's not the intent of these beers. So I like the lagers that will have, I can manipulate the final gravity based on what we do, in the brew house. So
are there any strains that are your favorite maybe?
I mean, there's some of the Czech lager ones that are supposed to be Pilsner Kettle, they're okay. I've had those beers, but I find a lot of the Munich ones are just as good, repeatable. And, the story, and this goes back to, what's a myth and what's the reality, that the yeast from that the Czech brewers used was, originally smuggled from Munich. We know that's a bit of a tall tale now. They just took the yeast and borrowed it, whatever. So sorry, there's similarities in the yeast strains between the two countries. I find that the Augustiner strain is a wonderful strain. It's predictable. It's highly influenced by your mash schedule. I can make, and I've talked to some other brewers about this, I think I'm nuts, but I can make a 10 Plato dark beer, finish it 4 to 5 Plato, and it doesn't taste sweet. And people just don't believe me.
But very cool.
It's great, because then you have resulting rich fullness in a 4% beer, and that's pretty tough. And that yeast is really impacted by having a high mash temperature. And it has stability too. It's not, the yeast fermentable extract, in that beer is pretty much, it's done. The beer's fully fermented. It's not like we've arrested fermentation at 4 Plato. And, that leads to a whole bunch of bottling issues. That if you have re-fermentation in the bottle, you're going to have some danger on hand. These beers are fully fermented, and the yeast has done its job, and it's not going to ferment anymore. All my beers are unfiltered, so that's obviously, a concern. And I've also used 3470. I use 3470 right now in my 10 Plato. Mm-hmm. Pale lager. And that has a nice character. The nice thing about that beer is that it's a quick turnaround. Augustiner is a little bit slower to ferment. It's not even a point Plato per day. It's a little bit slower than that. So you can have primary fermentation of up to 2 weeks, where the 3470, I'm pushing over one plate of fermentation a day, so we can get through it in a week, which is good because then we can do our diacetyl rest, and then we can, you know, set out to lager for a while to, you know, reduce sulfur compounds and make sure the beer clarifies a bit. You know, so it gives us some flexibility in the back end. You know, if you're having a yeast that is, and this is for, this is a commercial consideration, obviously homebrewing, you're a little more patient, but, you know, if it's commercial considerations, that we got to make sure we have a predictable time frame to get through the tanks and do and achieve everything we want in the tanks.
So
both those I've liked quite a bit. But I experiment, you know, if you want to do something a little bit stronger and you want that beer to be, you don't want that beer to be sweet, then look for, you know, high, a beer with high, a yeast with high attenuation. Any of the German strains I think are fun to deal with. There's a couple that I know other brewers are starting to deal with right now. And forgive me, I'm going to forget the name that people are having a lot of success with. I'm forgetting.
That's okay.
Ondex.
That's okay.
Lovely beers in a beautiful place. A couple of local brewers here are starting to use the Ondex yeast, and they've had really good success with that. I've yet to use that, but I hope to soon.
Well, obviously, fermentation and lagering are really important for this kind of beer. What kind of profile are you using to ferment out your beers and do your diacetyl rest and so on?
Depending on the yeast, I don't ferment as cold as, you know, some folks suggest. I typically knock out or chill the beer around 52 to 54 degrees. Bring that to the fermenter, pitch the yeast, and let that free rise to 56. And at 56, it's a really good temperature to keep any esters in control, but also ferment at a rate that's acceptable within a commercial brewery. You know, stainless is important. It's expensive and it's important. And I don't own the stainless I currently brew in, so I have to make sure that my brew gets through in a you know, reasonable time frame. So near the end of fermentation, we'll do a diacetyl check or diacetyl rest, and then we'll do a D test to make sure that, you know, we've cleared that hurdle. And at that point, which is a very easy test, I don't know if anyone home, you know, cares, but you basically take your fermented wort or your fermented beer at this point, which appears to have finished fermenting either through the airlock, no activity in the airlock, and then you're going to heat that for 15 minutes. And you can do that on the stovetop, you can do it in the microwave. You just need to get it to about 140 and hold it there for 10 to 15 minutes and then chill that. You then want to take that out of the fridge when it's cold and compare the aroma to another sample that hasn't gone through that heating process and see if there's any difference. I mean, you can tell right away if there's, you know, buttered popcorn in that aroma, and you know that the fermentation is not complete, that the yeast has not, you know, cleaned up what it needs to clean up, and that you wait.
Right? So you give it a longer diacetyl rest at the higher temperature, right?
Correct. And so you want that, it's a good point. You want that to rise. So around about, we think we're nearing the last 1/3 of the fermentation. We let the beer rise from 56 degrees to 60 degrees.
And that's the diacetyl rest where you're allowing the yeast to actually clean up naturally the flavor, right?
Correct. So you need to make sure you have enough cells, in suspension to actually do the job, and also have the temperature rise, because at lower temperatures, the diacetyl rest will take much longer, if at all. And that's one of the dangers of crashing the beer too soon, is that when you crash it, it's very difficult to recover from that if there's still diacetyl in the beer, because you're going to drop the yeast out of suspension, and it doesn't work at a very low temperature very well.
Yeah, so, for people looking to learn more, a couple of years back, I did a whole session on this on the podcast with Charlie Bamforth. We did a whole episode on diacetyl, but it was kind of fun.
It's a good one. And people are asking, well, wouldn't you just smell the diacetyl in the beer out of the fermenter? And you won't, because you have diacetyl precursor. It actually hasn't synthesized into diacetyl yet. And so heat will oxidize the beer, or help to oxidize it, and that will turn that diacetyl precursor into diacetyl. So that's hidden there. So you may smell the beer, taste the beer out of the fermenter, and be like, we're good to go. I'm gonna crash this. Once you package it and it comes to room temperature, or it starts to oxidize, you're going to start to develop buttered popcorn flavors.
And that's a great tip. I hadn't heard about, you know, heating in a microwave to do a quick test like that. That's really great.
Some people don't like the microwave way. I found it's foolproof. I mean, some people like to do a slow rise, you know, et cetera, but you can beat the beer up pretty good and get the result you need. Yeah. So again, it's a neat little trick that you can do, and there's no equipment that's required, and it's a very big step, because if you miss that one, there's no going back. Your beer is going to taste the way it does, and you can't recover.
Buttery popcorn forever, huh?
Yeah. No. Some Czech beers, back to our topic, some Czech beers do have, a little bit of diacetyl, and the brewers want that there. They claim, and Pilsner Kell has a parts per billion target they have, because they claim that it creates a palate fullness and a richness that they want in the beer. I am blind at low levels, so maybe that's why I tend to like some of those beers more than other folks. If you're very in tune with the smell, it can be very off-putting, right? So it's personal. It's probably why I like British bitters a lot. I don't really, if there's a small bit of diacetyl in there, I can't even smell them.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me much, but I know there's some people really sensitive to it. I Charlie Bamforth, for example, he said he almost can't even go to a movie because the butter popcorn flavor just drives him nuts.
Right. I mean, and a good point there, if you're going to do that D test and you have, you can't detect it at low levels, you better give that to someone else to take a sniff of it. And that's what I have to do. I'll go to the brewery, I'll do the D test, and I'll hand it to someone else who I know has a very, very, keen sense of that, because I'll miss it at very low levels.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to cover there. You have any great tips for turning, Czech lager into a session beer? Kind of a unique combination. I was just wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, my suggestion is what I would do for any session beer. Don't think of it as making beer X into a session beer. Think about it as creating a beer from scratch with a target in terms of flavor and aroma and texture, alcohol, color, et cetera. Everything you would do with a normal beer recipe. Don't take something and dumb it down. Build it up, because you're going to look at it a little bit different. And you start with a malt, and the first thing you do with the malt is like, all right, I want to build a lot of flavor in here. I'm not going to take a very neutral Canadian Pils malt and start making a session beer with this. I'm going to take something that has a little bit more character and that will make its way through to the final beer. I love Golden Promise. It's one of my favorite malts. If you're doing an ale, if you're doing an IPA, session IPA, for lack of a better term, or just a pale ale, look to some different malts that as a base malt will provide character. You can start looking at Vienna malts or Munich malts as a portion of that base malt. Start looking at things that are not traditional, grains, in larger beers. Take a look at oat malt, take a look at wheat, take a look at some other, take a look at rye, and start experimenting with those. Again, as base malts, not just as like a, 3%, I think this would be a nice little addition. Start thinking about those large proportions. And I think you're going to start seeing that you're going to be getting more flavor and character in that malt. And that's the base of it. Because if you don't have that base of malt character, then the criticism of session beer, which I fight, but I understand where people are coming from, is being, watery. You're going to start creating those. So, fight that with, a good quality grain and malt that's going to make its way to the finished flavor profile and not be clean. I know that the big trend right now is, the big trend right now are hoppy beers with very clean malt profile, so that the yeast is clean, or at least aromatic in a fruity way, and hops are the star. If you go down that route, you're going to make a very one note session beer. I don't think you can look at it in that way, unless that's the intent. If you want to make a one note session beer that has a little bit of mouth character and is all hops, that's fine too. I think the malt's a good place to start, and then just a lot of things we touched on already: water treatment. And then mash schedules, making sure that the beer doesn't dry out too much, unless that's the intent. I've made a couple of beers, like a Saison, for example. I want that beer to dry out and have a really, crisp, character in the finish. I make some hoppy wheat beers that I want to be very dry in the finish, and snappy and crisp. So, I'll do a little bit of a different mash schedule with that. And then take a look at hopping. You don't need a lot of IBUs to make an impact with a session beer. So take a look at some first wort hopping for lagers, and then take a look at late kettle or no kettle and all whirlpool. The utilization you can get at the homebrew level would be a post flame out, I guess, and the resting time between chilling and it just sits and waiting to get chilled.
Yeah, and hold it about 90 degrees C is what I usually tell people.
Yeah, and that's, you're going to get a lot of utilization there. And I've done tests where I've, you know, at each point in the process, I've had the same recipe and I've put in hops in a different process and gotten the beers analyzed for IBU, and I've been able to figure out a utilization scheme at my breweries and know exactly what the utilization is going to be at each point. And understand that, because if you're looking for a beer to be hoppy but not bitter, you know, you got to start thinking about pushing that additional weight to the end as one method. There's a million ways to skin a cat, but I think as a home brewer, it's a very easy way to start.
No, that's great advice. Well, I wanted to give a couple minutes here at the end for you to talk about your brewery, which of course is Notch Brewing. There's your website, notchbrewing.com, I think, right?
Yeah. So, Notch has been around now for, we're into our sixth year. We were the first brewery to focus exclusively on session beer or modest ABV. We've grew slowly. The first year was draft. We introduced bottles, and then we eliminated bottles altogether and went to cans exclusively. And that was a big change for us. And that really, it more than tenfold increased our sales. And so I kind of knew that I was hoping that would happen. And kind of knew that was going to happen. And session beer in a can makes a lot of sense, especially in occasion based drinking, summertime activities, etc. We have 2 year round beers. We have what I've talked about all through the whole interview here is a what I call a session pills. Desitka is the Czech word for 10. That doesn't really translate very well into the beer culture here, so I call it session pills. Left of the Dial IPA, which is a modest strength IPA. It's 4.3% alcohol. Citra, Mosaic, Golden Promise, really nice, non-bitter, fruity aroma, session IPA. And then I do a number of different styles. I do a single series that I call, and I do a different beer every 5 weeks. And that could be a number of lagers. It can be, just anything that is of session strength. And to this point, I've brewed well over 30 to 35 different beers under 4.5% alcohol. And then they're all listed on the site because sometimes we just come out with these so quickly. So it's been fun. One of my goals were to expand what the perception of session beer was in the United States, and that the perceptions right now, it's session IPA. And I think we're going to move past that. And I'm really focusing on lagers for the new brewery in Salem when we open next year, and to show a wide variety of lagers. Also, I'm a big fan of Berliner Weiss. We'll be doing a lot of different variants of Berliner Weiss. We'll be doing, some traditional British beers that couldn't be more out of fashion right now. I mean, I can't sell British beer in the market, but I'm pretty sure if we did the right way in our tap room, that we'll be able to sell it. Because I mean, that's one of the origins. It's not only Czech, but it's British, and a well-constructed British bitter to me on cask is just a wonderful thing. It's very difficult to sell right now in the age of IPA. So we've had good success, and it's been fun to see session beer evolve, and it's been fun that we've been along for the ride and been able to help it on its way. And I think we're going to see a lot of different session beer styles hit the market over the next couple of years as we become more mature and thinking about what we can produce at a lower gravity. But when I started Notch 6 years ago, I had an interview with Lou Bryson. And Lou's been a very big advocate of session beer. He has the Session Beer Project website. I said, think about if all the brewers in our collective creativity in the United States focused on session beer and not on barrel aging or the new hop variety in a double IPA. What if we all focused on session beers? And not just session IPAs. So think about the creativity that could come out of that. And I think only now we're starting to see that. We're really starting to see some creativity at the lower end of the ABV scale, and that people are valuing those beers for what they are, that they're flavorful and interesting, and they just happen to be lower alcohol.
Awesome. Well, real quick, where is the new location?
So we're going to be at 283 Rare Derby Street. It's right in downtown Salem. We abut the South River, so we're going to have a 1,500 square foot beer hall, and then basically 2,000 square foot beer garden.
I mean, you're right in the historic district there in Salem, Massachusetts, just a little north of Boston, right?
Yeah, right downtown. And this is going to be our, a production brewery, but a lot of R&D that will be coming out of the brewery as well. So half of it will go over the bar, and then half will go at our back door to our current retail accounts.
Awesome. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add, Chris?
I think that's it. I mean, we've covered a great deal, and I'm really excited to see Czech beer coming to the forefront. I think there's a lot of things there that are just wonderful, and they're great drinking beers, and the beers that I personally love. So it's for me, it's fun to see that. I'm really enjoying seeing Czech beer getting some attention.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. You've done a great job covering a lot of material that, you know, a lot of people haven't thought about this way.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
So thanks again to Chris Loring from Notch Brewing. He's the founder of Notch Brewing in Salem, Massachusetts. He's been a professional brewer since 1993, and you can find out more at notchbrewing.com. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again to Chris Loring for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, where you can get your 15% discount on their magazine or anything in their store if you use the offer code BEERSMITH2015 when you shop at beerandbrewing.com. Again, use the offer code BEERSMITH2015 when you shop at beerandbrewing.com. And also, BEERSMITH software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers, lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your 21-day trial free today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.